today. The lives that were lost tragically 15 years ago. We remember acts of heroism. We saw 15 years ago humanity at its worst and humanity at its best. And as we think about the future, as we think about our future, not only as a country, but as a species, as humanity in the world, our deepest prayer is that what is written in our scriptures would one day be reality. That our weapons of death and destruction would be transformed into implements of life and nourishment. Swords into plowshares. That we would learn violence and train for violence no more. That we would reject this myth of redemptive violence and instead embrace the path of Jesus, which calls us to our best selves, which calls us to be transformed, which calls us to love. May that begin in us. May those who need your comfort today receive your comfort. And may those of us today who need to be disturbed be disturbed. May we be open. May we be challenged. May we be critiqued. May we be convicted. May we experience whatever it is we need today. We ask this in the strong name of Jesus who is with us. And everybody said, amen. So a couple years ago, I was in the grad program for religion at Western. And one of the things they told us early in the program was you have to write a thesis. And this thesis had to be somewhere between 100 and 150 pages, and it had to be well-researched, and it had to go through this committee, and you had to present in front of this committee, and they had to believe it was credible, and then they all read it and tore it to shreds, and there was going to be this whole process, right, where your value and self-worth as a human being was going to be determined by three or four people who are on your thesis committee. And I was trying to decide if I was going to commit 2 years of my life to a project, I wanted to make sure it was a project that I thought was worth 2 years of my life. I didn't want to get to the end of it and go, well, that was a bummer. I didn't want to get to the end of it and think, well, I really don't feel strongly about this. I actually think it's quite boring. And so I just started reading, and I just tried to figure out what is it that's interesting to me right now in the world of religion. And one of the things that I started noticing, this was about 2013, I started noticing there were all these new polls being released, all these new statistics being released about religion, specifically religion in the West, and even more specifically religion in America. And people were asking Americans about their religious habits and their religious beliefs and their religious convictions. And everything that was being released had sort of a catchy headline, and it read something like this: the shifting religious landscape of America. And what people began to notice when they sat down with average Americans and just started having conversations about their lives and their beliefs, what they began to realize is that the opinions and beliefs religiously, theologically, spiritually that Americans had were actually really beginning to shift in a dramatic sort of way. So what I want to do today, if you're a numbers person, if you're a statistics person, then today is your day. So statistics, I can't say the word, but you know what I'm talking about. Y'all unite. Next week, we're going to jump in. So today, what I want to do is I want to lay the groundwork. If you've ever been to a movie and you know they show like, what, 35, 40 minutes of previews before the movie even begins, today is the preview. And then starting next week and for the next 5 weeks, we're going to watch the movie. And essentially, I want to explore over the next 5 weeks some of the reasons for the numbers I'm going to give you today, okay? So I want to just begin with the Pew Research Center released some statistics in 2015 about the years 2007 to 2014. And what they began to define was this, that in America between 2007 and 2014, in 2007, 78.4 Americans identified as Christian. They essentially said, we're a part of this religion. Now, there's all sorts of different breakdowns within that, right? You have your Catholics, you have your Protestants. And when you start looking at Protestants, it gets real weird and divided real fast, right? Because Protestants, the word protest, we just want to protest everybody, right? And so when we just don't like somebody, what do? We start a new denomination and we uninvite those people. And so that's essentially, when you talk about Christianity in America, it's this big umbrella that's talking about Catholics and Protestants. And under that, it's talking about Baptists and Methodists and Lutherans and Episcopalians and all the other Palians out there that are somehow involved in this thing called Christianity. Now, in 7 years, in 2014, that number had dropped to 70.6%. Now, think about this, though. Still, in this country, in these United States, 7 in 10 people identify as Christian. I'm not great at math, but I think that turns out to be 70%, right? 70% of Americans identify as Christian. And I bring this up just to say to you, my brothers and sisters, we are not a persecuted minority. We are still the vast majority. And when Christians in America running around talking about how persecuted we are, we do a disservice to our brothers and sisters in the world who actually are. They're losing their lives. They're losing their jobs. They're losing their incomes. They're losing their families for this thing. And we're not. So the reality is the vast majority of Americans, 70.6%, identify as Christians. But what you'll also know is that's a pretty considerable drop in 7 years' time, isn't it? You went from 78 to 70. That's roughly a right at 8% decrease. They talked to these people in 2007, 78% were Christians. They came back and asked people again in 2014, and now it's just 70%. So that category is dropping. The fastest growing category, though, are these group of people called unaffiliateds. In 2007, 16.1% of the population in America said, we are unaffiliated. We are a religious free agent. Right? We don't affiliate with any religious tradition. We're not Christian. We're not Muslim. We're not Buddhist. We're not Hindu. We're some of them, like maybe we're confused. Maybe we're atheist. Maybe whatever. We are not in a category of religious belief. That was in 2007, and there were 16.1% of them. Today, or in 2014, and believe it or not, this number is higher today, the number was 22.8%. You wonder where those percentage of Christians went, by the way? A good chunk of them went where? Unaffiliated. We used to be this, but we've been losing our religion, and now we're going to be this. We're unaffiliated. We can no longer associate ourselves with the religious tradition that is called Christianity. In 2007, there were 16% of our population that were unaffiliated, and in 2014, that number had grown to 22%, and it's still steadily, every year, that number is steadily moving up. Now, among millennials, and this is my generation, it started in 1981, which is the year I was born, and it ended in the year 2000. How many of you in the room are a millennial? Okay, there are some millennials in the room. These are probably the people, if you're a baby boomer, you think they're the problem, right? But they're not the problem. I want to say right off the gate, millennials aren't the problem. Millennials, what's interesting is in 2007, 25% of millennials said that they were unaffiliated. In 2014, that number had grown to 34%, and today it's even higher. Millennials, 1981 to the year 2000, which is a big chunk of people, right? These people, my people, are 34% unaffiliated, and that number is continuing to move up. By the way, in Kentucky, 22% of our population are unaffiliated in Kentucky. So if you lined up 10 people, every 2.2 people would be unsure, unaffiliated, unconnected to a religious tradition. Now back to millennials. 7 in 10 Americans are Christians. 7 in 10 millennials leave church by age 23. So people from 1981 to the year 2000, 7 in 10 of them, when they hit age 23, have made a choice, they've made a decision that they can no longer be a part of this thing called church. And they're leaving all, so if you grew up in a specific tradition, don't feel bad. They're leaving the Catholics, they're leaving the Baptists, they're leaving the Lutherans, they're leaving anybody who has some sort of Christian affiliation, and they're going to this new category that's growing called unaffiliated. When I came to MCC to be on staff here, I was 23 years of age. And what's interesting is those first few years here, I was, just to be very honest, I was deciding not only do I want to be a pastor with my life, is do I even want to go to church anymore? And so I get that. That period of time in my life was super tumultuous. It was super confusing. And it was confusing because there were all sorts of things I read in the Bible about Jesus that seemed compelling and intriguing and interesting, things worth giving your life to and worth giving your life for. And the things I was experiencing in the wider church weren't those things. Right? The things I was experiencing from other Christians, it wasn't something that I would be willing to give my life for or give my life to. If you have a grandchild who's in their late teens, early 20s, chances are, if there are enough of you in the room with grandchildren, you remember that first day of college when they're like, look to your right, look to your left, one of you is not going to graduate. And you realize you were on somebody's right or left, correct? And they were talking about you, and maybe you proved them wrong. Right, but if we just take that same sort of really strategic approach. Look to your right, look to your left. Somebody in this room's grandkid is going to stop going to church by the time they turn 23, if they haven't already. And you're going to keep inviting them. And because you're their grandma, they're going to be polite. But when you turn around, they're going to roll their eyes. Because they have no idea why this is something you would give your time to. Right? Religion in America is not on the uptick. Specifically, Christianity in America is not on the uptick. But what's super interesting, 40% of the unaffiliated say they have a regular sense of spiritual well-being and peace. Almost half of the people who say, not a part of that, regularly report having a sense of God's presence in their life. They regularly report having a sense of peace and a sense of spiritual well-being. If you were to ask them, if you were to die tonight, you know what they would say? I'm good. I have a sense of God in my life. I sense God's presence. I sense God's peace. I sense God's comfort. I sense God's reality. Right? So in this unaffiliated, it's like something like 7% of the unaffiliated category would identify as atheist. A little bigger chunk would identify as agnostic. But the biggest chunk would say, we're absolutely spiritual. We believe in God. We believe that God is a reality that can be experienced. What we're saying is the place we were supposed to experience this God and the tribe in which we were supposed to experience this God, we went and we didn't find God there. We found rules. We found judgment. We found fear. We found manipulation. But we didn't find God. 40% of the unaffiliated say, I have a regular sense of God's presence, of God's witness, that God is with me, that God is available to me, and that I have a connection with God. 40%. Can I just be honest? I would be surprised if that number among Christians was that high. Right? I mean, if you lined up 10 Christians, do you think at least 4 of them would say, I have a regular sense of God's presence and God's peace and God's just that God is with me? There have been times of that for me, but there have also been times for me when I haven't had that sense at all. And I've been at church every second of my life, it seems like. Right? Every second. I was going to church in the womb, and like the day after I was born, they took me to church just to make sure some of it would rub off. Right? I've grown up in church. And there are regular times in my life, in my own spiritual journey, and this is not like super past tense to make me seem more spiritual now. There are regular times when I'm just like, is this thing on? Is anybody listening? Is anybody there? Is there this, what is this all about? And so I think we have some choices to make. What do we do? There's this great verse in Chronicles, and this is a story about David's troops, David's soldiers, and all the different tribes of Israel sent him people to be a part of his group. And there's this one group called the tribe, the Sons of Issachar. And it says that David received some troops from this group of people, from Issachar. And it describes what these different groups were like. And notice this description. From Issachar, those who understood the times and what Israel should do, they sent 200 chiefs with all their relatives under their command. Notice the descriptor. These people understood the times, and they knew what to do. They understood the situation. They got the context of their lives. They understood what was going on, and they had a real sense of, I know exactly what we need to do right now. This is how things are, and this is how we're going to respond to it. Isn't it great to have those sorts of people in your life, by the way? Like when everything seems to be crumbling and it seems like there's one person in the room who, when everybody else is losing their mind, they have like this little shred of sanity left and they can give you wisdom and they can say, hey, you should do this. I'm grateful for those people in my life. I'm grateful that every time I have something really brilliant to say in a comeback to somebody over something serious, that a lot of times I get to bounce it off those people and they're like, you should never say that to anyone. That is not okay. You need to find a way to be like, I don't know, Jesus-y with it or something. Right? The people who understand the times and know what to do. And if we look at our world that we find ourselves in, we have to respond to this. If being Christian matters to us and being a part of a religious tradition matters to us, then our tradition has to respond to it. And I think I've thought about this for 2 years, and I wrote my entire thesis around this. And if you're really bored on a Saturday, I can lend you a copy. But I'm just going to save you this and say, I think we have some options. And I think our options are this. I think one was we could just deny there's a problem. That seems to always work, right? we'll just deny the problem. We'll just stick our heads in the sand and wait for things to kind of come around and be better. That's what religious people do a lot. If there's a problem, what do? We ignore it, right? We're not going to talk about it. We're not going to have an awkward conversation. We're not going to do any of that stuff. We're just going to pretend that everything's great. And as long as people are filling our seats on Sunday mornings, that's all that matters. Let's forget about our kids. Let's forget about our grandkids. Let's forget about all that stuff. And let's just worry about today. Aren't you glad our most ancient ancestors who were hunting and gathering in the woods did not have that mentality? See, I think this is a problem with the human race, is we used to think about future generations, and now we just think about our own afterlife experience. And we've ceased to ask the question, if the world continues, and if humanity continues, what kind of religious tradition will my son inherit? Because he's going to inherit one, and he's either going to reject it, or it's going to be meaningful for him, and it's going to give shape and meaning to his life. And that decision is not going to be made when he turns 18. That decision is being made today, by the religious community we have him as a part of, by the relationships we have in our lives with other people. Like, those decisions, what he's going to think about Christianity when he is my age, it's not going to be determined then. It's going to be determined now. And I've got to tell you, if I hadn't fallen into some, I've been very fortunate and super lucky to bump into the right people at the right time who saved Christianity for me. Because if I hadn't, I wouldn't be here. If I hadn't bumped into somebody who was saying it a little bit differently, and then somebody who was saying it a lot differently, and somebody who was challenging some of the notions I grew up with, I would not be here today. I would not be a pastor. I don't know what I would be doing. I would probably be serving somebody coffee somewhere. But I wouldn't be doing this, and I wouldn't be attending church. Several somebodies saved the faith for me. And this thing matters to me. This thing matters to me. And I want my son, and I want your kids, and I want our grandkids and our great-grandkids, I want them to grow up with a faith that they can live with. One that doesn't make them feel ashamed or embarrassed, but one that inspires them to go do good and make a difference in the world they find themselves in. We could deny it, but if we deny it, essentially we're passing off today's problems on tomorrow's people. We're saying we don't have the guts to fix this or deal with it, so you deal with it later. We're going to go to our graves feeling really good about what we did. And that doesn't seem to be a good solution. So we could deny, but that really doesn't help anybody. We could blame. And this is the thing I hear religious people doing a lot. People are leaving Christianity. Well, people just don't love God like they used to. I'll tell you, I talk to people in my family regularly who say that to me. People don't love God like they used to. People don't pray like they used to. People don't go to church like they used to. And guess who's to blame for that? People. Right? Well, people don't want to go to church anymore. People don't want to pray anymore. People don't want to believe in God anymore. And I think at some point we have to ask the question, what are we doing that makes people not want to come to church anymore? What are we doing that makes people look at God and go, if that's it, I'm out? But what tends to happen is we want to blame. We want to blame, and we want to turn up the speaker louder and just say the same things we've been saying forever and ever and ever, and we just say them louder and more angry, and maybe people will fall into line. Right? That's a parenting strategy, by the way, isn't it? Your kid's not listening, and so you immediately find your dad voice. You're like, hey! Which they don't listen to any better, right? And so why in the world would we imagine that if we just say the same things better, or the same things louder, why would we imagine it would make a difference? I mean, if you listen to some of the things we say to people, and people put out these memes on Facebook that really offend everybody, but some of them are true, right? I mean, here's an example of one. God says to you, I love you so much, but if you don't straighten up, really? This is good news? God loves you so much, but if you don't straighten up, God's not going to love you very much anymore. That just doesn't sound like good news. We could blame them. Whoever them are, the 20-some percent, we could blame them and say, if you guys would just fall into line, and if you'd stop asking so many pesky questions, then maybe, just maybe, Christianity would be doing okay in America. A lot of times I drive by churches, and on almost every church sign in America, there'll at some point be some version of this. Everyone what? Welcome. Everyone welcome. If that isn't the biggest false advertising in the history of false advertising, I don't know what is. What we tend to mean by that is everyone's welcome for a second. But if you don't fall into line real quick, you got 2 weeks to fix this. Right? You got 2 weeks to fix your problems. And if you don't fix your problems, then everybody's not going to be so welcome anymore. And you're going to start hearing sermons about the things you struggle with. Forget about what I struggle with. This isn't about me. This is about you. It's about getting your life right. Every time, and I always wonder, one of the things we've always said here is everybody's welcome. I just wonder, is that really true? Is that really true? Is it really true that everybody's welcome here? Is it really true that anybody can come and find Jesus here? Is it really true that anybody can find community and love and acceptance here? Because I think when churches say that, if we don't mean it, then we're lying to people. And their first experience is, you said I was welcome, but what you meant was, I was welcome if I agreed with you, if I believed like you, if I thought like you, if I dressed like you, if I got a haircut like you, if I voted like you, if I liked the same things you do. Then I was accepted. I can remember when I started asking questions. And there was a time in my life when I was a kid where I would go to church and I would hear things, and some of it didn't add up, but I just didn't ask questions. You know what I mean? Like, it's almost like if you pull back the curtain and you see the man behind the curtain and you know that the great and powerful Oz is just a little dude over here, then that's going to be a problem. And so I didn't ask questions for a long time, but what I found out is when you start asking questions, when I started asking my mentors at the time questions, their love and approval of me diminished quickly, and their anger went up quickly. Just don't ask so many questions. Everyone's welcome, but don't bring your questions, because if you ask a question we can't answer, then we get really, really, really upset. We could blame. The problem is you don't believe enough. The problem is you don't go to church enough. The problem, but here's what's happening. As we blame, more and more people are walking out the door. And if you believe that a religious community like ours adds value to somebody's life, if you believe it matters in any way, then the idea that people are leaving and perhaps not finding any communities to be a part of, that's a problem, isn't it? I mean, we believe that transformation happens best in community, in relationship. I'm not going to become the best version of me on my own. I'm depending on some of you for that, to come alongside me and to walk with me and to love me even when I'm super unlovable and to be there for me and to encourage me. I'm counting on you for me to become my best self. And this is going to shock you. You can't become your best self either. There is no such thing as a self-made man or woman. It does not exist. It is a lie. It is a lie. I can't forget what movie it was from, but there's this line where the guy's talking and he starts getting all weepy and he says, I built this entire company myself. I came up from nothing with just a dream and $1 million loan from my father. Right? Nobody is a self-made person. So we could deny, we could just ignore the problem and we could pretend like it's not there. And when our kids and grandkids are in charge of this thing called the Christian faith, it's going to be smaller and smaller and smaller. We could just blame everybody and that's going to keep people running for the doors. Or we could do something that is radical and revolutionary. This is going to blow you away. You would never have thought of this. I didn't think of it. I had to have other people tell me this. Or we could listen. We could listen. We could actually listen to the people who are leaving and ask them, why is it that you can't do this anymore? What is it about Christianity? What is it about Christians? What is it about church that makes you feel like I can no longer be a part of that? There's an author named Pete Enns. Have anybody ever read a book by Pete Enns? He's written several. He's got one called For the Bible Tells Me So, which is great. And his newest one is called The Sin of Certainty. And he talks about the difference between faith and certainty. Faith and trust we have, certainty we can't have. But in the book, one of the things he does is he basically talks about a time when he asked people this question. In 2013, he wrote this on his blog. What are your one or two biggest obstacles to staying Christian? What are those roadblocks you keep running into? What are those issues that won't go away and make you wonder why you keep on believing at all? And I wonder if we were to ask this question of those of us in this room, I wonder what we would say. Because I bet, statistics being what they are, I bet there are people in this room right now who the idea of hanging like a thread describes your religious practice perfectly. You're barely hanging on. You don't know if you want to hang on. You don't know if there's anything in religion worth hanging on to anymore. You maybe believe in God, but you're not sure that God can even be found in a religious tradition because it seems like the followers of the tradition act so different than the founders of the tradition. And so you're hanging by a thread. What is it that's making you hang by a thread? Or And for those of you who are here and you're like, I've never doubted a thing in my life, I've just always believed wholeheartedly, then this maybe will be enlightening for you to see how the other half lives. Because there are lots and lots of people in the world right now, in our country, and in our state, 22%, are asking these sorts of questions. And so when he asked us on his blog, here he got five responses. Well, he got a lot of responses. He said they all boiled down into five basic questions that he would seek to somehow speak to. And I don't think you can answer these questions. And here's why. I can't speak for all the Christians in the world. I can't speak for all the Christians in this room. Most of the time, I can't speak for all the Christians in my house, right? So, like, here's the reality. We just can't do that. There are a bunch of Christians, and not all of us agree on any of it. So, I can't speak for everybody, but here's what I can say. Over the next 5 weeks, I'm going to seek to speak to these five issues, these five questions, and offer my perspective on it, and you can do what you want with that, and you can think about it, and maybe over a meal group, you can offer your perspectives, and we'll see what happens. The first thing he got back was the question, is God violent? One of the big issues people had with the Bible is that Christians run around condemning other religious traditions because of their violence and their violent scriptures, and we've not actually read our own. And if you want to find some real blood and gore, you need to look no further than the Bible, because it's in there. And it's in there gratuitously at times. Is God violent? At times, the Bible portrays God as a violent, reactive, vengeful, bloodthirsty, and downright mean deity. Right? God actually, in the Bible, destroys pretty much everything on creation in a big genocide called the flood. Right? God says to his people liberated from Egypt, I want you to go into Canaan and do what? Kill them all, and I'll sort them out. Right? So at times in the Bible, it seems like God is just telling other people to do the violent stuff. But then at times, it seems like God's getting God's hands dirty too. Is God violent? Is our understanding of God that God sometimes uses violence to get God's work done? Because there are a growing number of people, especially millennials, who are looking at this and saying, if I'm more moral than God is, we have a problem. Would you agree? If your sense of morality is bigger than God's, then we need a new God. And I actually don't think that's the case. And we'll talk about that next week. Second, do I have to reject science to be a Christian? The Bible and modern science seem to conflict in places. So what do we do with that? Do we have to pick between our faith and our rationality? Do we have to pick between what the Bible says and what science is telling us about the universe we find ourselves in? And so we'll spend a week exploring that. There's so much suffering in the world, so much injustice and so much pain. How can God be good if we suffer? And I think it was C.S. Lewis who had the famous, either God is all-powerful but not all-good, because if God was all-powerful, he could end all suffering, but he's not all-good, so he won't. Or God is all-good, he really, really wants to help us, but God isn't all-powerful, so God can't do it. Are those the only options we have? Because that sounds pretty bad, too. And so we'll spend a week talking about suffering, talking about pain. What do we do with our suffering? How do we make sense of the pain we feel and the idea that there's this God of love who started this whole thing and who still everything exists in this God of love? Number four, there are 7 billion people on the planet. Somebody counted. Wouldn't you hate to have that job? Like, stop moving around. We got to get you. 7 billion people on the planet, and only 2.2 billion of those people are Christians. Do I have to believe that roughly 4.8 billion people are going to hell? As a Christian, do I have to be hostile toward other religions? Do I have to see them as my enemies? So does being strongly Christian, being convicted that the Christian faith is the tradition you belong in, the tradition that's changing your life, the tradition that is right for you, do you have to then believe that everybody else is bad? And do you have to then have a posture of anger toward all other religions? So that if you bump into a Buddhist, you have to be really mad about it. Is that how it has to work? And then number five. Number five. Christians can be really mean sometimes toward outsiders, but even toward insiders. Christians can be really, really mean sometimes. Back in 2004 or 2005, there's this movie came out called Saved. Tell me you saw the movie Saved. If you're easily offended, please don't watch it, because you'll be very offended. But the reality is, this movie is a great caricature and a great critique of sort of that whole evangelical brand of Christianity that I grew up in. And there's this one scene in the movie where, just to give you a little bit of the plot line to spoil it a bit. There's a girl named Mary who's a teenager and pregnant. Does that story sound familiar? She's a teenager, she's pregnant, and she's at this evangelical Christian school, and sort of she's the scandal of the school, and everybody's really worried about her. And there's this scene played by one of the lead characters is Mandy Moore. I mean, if Mandy Moore is the lead in a movie, you know you're onto something here, right? I mean, you can't go wrong. And so I want you to see this scene. They're going to try to enact an intervention on Mary to save her soul. Check this out.
Hey, ladies. Sorry. You got a second?
Yeah.
Listen, I'm concerned about Mary. Something's going on.
Yeah, me too.
Well, she's part of your posse, and I think that you can help her. I'm going to need you to be a warrior out there on the front lines for Jesus.
You mean like shoot her?
No. I was thinking of something a little less gangsta. I need someone who's spiritually armed to help guide her back to her faith. The love and care that only Jesus can supply. You down with that?
Yeah, I'm down with that.
She's pretty vulnerable right now, so I'm going to need you to be extra gentle.
I'm going.
So are you not going to accept our intervention here?
Yeah. Kidnapping? No.
You are backsliding into the flames of hell.
Yeah. You've become a magnet for sin. We've all witnessed it.
Yes. Sure. Veronica acting all pure. What about last spring break at the Promise Makers rally, huh?
Oh, my God. You are making accusations. As we're trying to save your soul. Mary, turn away from Satan. Jesus, he loves you.
You don't know the first thing about love.
I am filled with Christ's love.
God,
you are just jealous of my success in the Lord.
This is not a weapon, you idiot.
On an occasion to use, you are just jealous of my success in the Lord. That's such a great line. And obviously that's a movie, but I bet if we were to take a poll, I bet most of us in this room have in some way been wounded by people that were supposed to be our brothers and sisters. I'll just be honest with you. The worst treatment I've received in my life, my entire life, my whole life, has not come from the hands of non-believers or Satanists or outsiders. The worst treatment I've ever had in my life has come from Christians. The meanest things that people have said about me behind my back or on Facebook, people not speaking to me at the grocery store because my heresy might be contagious. The worst treatment I have ever received in my life has been from Christians. And so I think we have to ask the question, do you realize this? Christians have a reputation in the world. When people see a Christian come on television to do an interview, they don't automatically think, well, isn't that great? There's a Christian. I bet they're going to talk about love and compassion and understanding. And when most of the time, 9 times out of 10, that Christian starts to speak, it's the exact opposite of that. I mean, I just wish there was this way of letting everybody in the world know, the rest of the 7 billion, when a Christian says something dumb, I'm not with them. That's not my tradition. That's not who I am. And I think we have to begin to speak to this reality that we not only will be hateful toward outsiders, but we often shoot our own. We eat our own. Why would anybody sign up for that? If you're pretty much guaranteed to just be hurt and wounded, I'm pretty sure we could work real hard to find that outside of a Christian community. Why in the world would I want to go someplace where they're going to talk about me, where they're going to be mean to me, where they're not going to accept me, where they're going to judge me? Why would I go there? And perhaps we need to stop blaming people for leaving, and we need to start looking at our own behavior and the traditions we've created and the places of worship we've created where people, we tell them they're welcome and they're really not. Or when somebody struggles or somebody makes a mistake or somebody falls apart, then we stand back and judge that person instead of coming around them and loving them into health. I mean, it should be that if you were struggling, the best place to be would be in a Christian community where you could go and say, I am struggling with this. And people would come around you and love you and support you. But too often, when somebody confesses something like that to us, we turn it into a prayer request. It's really not about prayer, is it? You ever gotten one of those prayer requests? You ever given one of those prayer requests? Would you just pray for so-and-so? She is a vehicle for Satan right now, you know? Like that. What compels people to join a place when they're not safe? What compels people to want to be a part of something that they're afraid is just going to further wound them and not bring them toward healing? It's a shame that some people have had to leave church to get healthy. It's a shame that some people have had to leave a Christian community looking for the very thing that community should provide. And I will guarantee you our church has not been immune to that. I'm certain we've hurt people in the past, and we shouldn't have. And so at some point, we have to come around and say, look, these are the facts. The people are leaving. They're leaving Christianity altogether. And it's not just, you know, it used to be they were leaving liberal mainline churches, but now even among conservative evangelicals, their numbers are dropping. They're baptizing less and less people. It's happening. What are we going to do with it? And I bet there's a lot more that's not on this list maybe that you've thought of. But these are the five, of all the responses he got from around the country, these were the five things that were causing people, especially people my age and younger, to leave church. And we can either plug our ears and pretend like it's not happening, we can either start throwing around blame, or we can start listening to these things, and we can start asking, how is it that we're approaching our faith that maybe, while it's worked for us for a long, long time, maybe for some people it's not working and it's actually driving them away? Brian McLaren has a new book coming out in a couple weeks, on the 20th of this month, and it's called The Great Spiritual Migration, and he's actually dealing with this topic, which I'm really excited to read his thoughts on. But last week, an article came out that had a quote from his book in it, and he's dealing with Jesus. And one of the things he's talking about in this quote, I'm going to share it with you as we close, one of the things he's talking about is that if you read the Bible, you get a certain picture of Jesus, but then when you listen to people talk about Jesus, that picture quickly changes sometimes. And so for lots and lots of people, we're confused. We're confused about which Jesus we're being given. Not that there's more than one Jesus, but there's several different takes on Jesus and versions of Jesus. And sometimes it seems like the version of Jesus I see in the media, the version of Jesus I hear from pulpits, the version of Jesus I hear when I'm eavesdropping poorly at doctor's offices, you know, all those things you do. Like, the Jesus I'm hearing about doesn't seem to be the Jesus I met in the Bible. Here's what he says. No wonder more and more of us who are Christians by birth, by choice, or both, find ourselves asking, shaking our heads and asking, what happened to Christianity? We feel as if our founder has been kidnapped and held hostage by extremists. His captors parade him in front of cameras to say under duress things he obviously doesn't believe. As their blank-faced puppet, he often comes across as anti-poor, anti-environment, anti-gay, anti-intellectual, anti-immigrant, and anti-science. And that is not the Jesus we meet in the Gospels. That is not the Jesus we meet in the Gospels. That is not the Jesus who says that at the end of all things, we'll be evaluated on how we treated the poor, the orphan, the stranger, the imprisoned. That is not that Jesus. The Jesus we often see paraded around in front of cameras is not the Jesus who set a table before him and welcomed all people to come to the table, regardless of whether or not they agreed with him or not. The Jesus that's being paraded around in our world often is a Jesus that does not match this Christ we meet in Scripture. So what I want to explore over the next 5 weeks after today is, if we take these five issues and we try to understand them through the lens of Jesus, through the lens of this is who Jesus is, this is what Jesus said, this is who Jesus called us to be in the world, what kind of faith would we create? How would it change our heritage? And would it make a difference moving forward so that our kids and our grandkids can be a part of a vibrant, thriving, just, and generous Christianity? You know, there's that Tim McGraw song, Humble and Kind. How many of you are Tim McGraw fans? You know, there's this line that says, go to church because your mama says to. That's a terrible reason to go to church. Maybe when you're a kid, it's a great reason because they make you. I want my kid to get to the point in his life where he goes to church not because me and his mom tell him to, but because he's a part of something that makes sense in his life, because it's vibrant, it's alive, and it's making the world better. It's bringing heaven to earth, which is what Jesus prayed for. So what I'm advocating, like, what are you getting? Here's what I'm advocating. This is going to be revolutionary and radical. I'm advocating we get back to a Christianity that is centered on the life and teachings and practice of Jesus. And I'm advocating that as we get back to that, we will see a transformed faith that has the potential and the capacity to transform us and transform our communities and transform the whole wide world. We are losing our religion. And I'm not actually convinced that that's a bad thing. Because what we may find in the journey of losing may be a more vibrant and alive tradition than we could have ever gotten our heads and hearts around to begin with. Does that make sense? So join us next week as we dive into this idea of, is God violent? Do we have to believe that God is somehow mean-spirited, vindictive, vengeful, all that stuff? Let's have a word of prayer. God, we are grateful for this 2,000-year-old tradition we're a part of. We're grateful that there have been times during this 2,000-year period where people have come along and said, we need to rethink the whole thing. We need to get back to Jesus. We need to get back to the life and teachings of Jesus, which then could move us forward in all sorts of new and exciting ways. So God, my prayer for us the next 5 weeks is this. If we're here this morning and we're hanging by a thread, or maybe we're just done with religion, we're annoyed with it, we've been hurt by it, we just put out with it. If we're done with religion, give us the courage for the next 5 weeks to be open to hearing something else. Something that may transform the way we think about God, something that may transform the way we think about Jesus, that may transform the way we think about faith. Just give us the courage to be open-minded enough to hear and open-hearted enough to respond. And for those of us who, maybe not physically, but in our hearts right now, our arms are crossed and we're just upset. Why would anybody have a problem with the tradition I grew up with? Would you give us the courage to be open, open-minded, open-hearted? Would you give us the courage to listen to those who are leaving and to rethink some of the things we've been handed? Would you give us the courage to try to move toward Jesus, toward the teaching and life of Christ that has the capacity and potential to transform not only us, but the whole wide world? So let us hold this space, let us hold this tension with as much grace as possible, we pray. We ask this in the name of Jesus, and everybody said, let's stand together.